Osho, the Heart Sutra, talks on Prajna Paramita Hridayam Sutra of Gautama the Buddha, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 3.
Bhagwan, here, O Sariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Here, O Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete.
Knowledge is the curse, the calamity, the cancer. It is through knowledge that man becomes divided from the whole. Knowledge creates a distance. You come across a wild flower in the mountains. You don't know what it is. Your mind has nothing to say about it. The mind is silent. You look at the flower. You see the flower, but no knowledge arises in you. There is wonder. There is mystery. The flower is there, you are there. Through wonder, you are not separate, you are bridged. If you know that this is a rose, or a marigold, or something else, that very knowing disconnects you. The flower is there, you are here, but there is no bridge. You know. Knowledge creates distance. The more you know, the bigger is the distance. The less you know, the lesser the distance. And if you are in the moment of not knowing, there is no distance. You are bridged. You fall in love with a woman or a man. The day you fall in love, there is no distance. There is only wonder, a thrill, an excitement, an ecstasy, but no knowledge. You don't know this woman who she is. Without knowledge, there is nothing to divide you. Hence the beauty of those first moments of love. You have lived with the woman only for 24 hours, knowledge has arisen. Now you have some ideas about the woman, who she is, you know. There is an image. 24 hours have created a past. Those 24 hours have left marks on the mind. You look at the same woman, there is no more the same mystery. You are coming down the hill. That peak is lost. To understand this is to understand much. To understand that knowledge divides. Knowledge creates distance. Is to understand the very secret of meditation. Meditation is a state of not knowing. Meditation is pure space, undisturbed by knowledge. Yes, the biblical story is true that man has fallen through knowledge by eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge. No other scripture of the world surpasses that. That parable is the last word. No other parable has reached to that height and insight. It looks so illogical that man has fallen through knowledge. It looks illogical because the logic is part of knowledge. The logic is all in support for knowledge. It looks illogical because logic is the root cause of man's fall. A man who is absolutely logical, absolutely sane, always sane, never allows any illogic in his life, is a madman. Sanity needs to be balanced by insanity. Logic needs to be balanced by illogic. The opposites meet and balance. A man who is just rational is unreasonable. He will miss much. In fact, all that is beautiful and all that is true, he will go on missing. He will collect trivia. His life will be a mundane life. He will be the worldly man. That biblical parable has immense insight. Why man has fallen out of knowledge? Because knowledge creates distance. Because knowledge creates I and thou. Because knowledge creates subject and object, the knower and the known, the observer and the observed. Knowledge basically is schizophrenic. It creates a split. And then there is no way to bridge it. That's why the more man has become knowledgeable, the less religious. The more educated a man, the less is the possibility for him to approach God. Jesus is right when he says only children will be able to enter into my kingdom. Only children. What is that quality that a child has and you have lost? The child has the quality of non-knowledge, innocence. He looks with wonder. His eyes are absolutely clear. He looks deep, but he has no prejudices, no judgments, no a priori ideas. He does not project. Hence he comes to know that which is. The other day we were talking about the distinction between reality and truth. The child knows the truth, you know only the reality. The reality is that which you have created around yourself, projecting, desiring, thinking. The reality is your interpretation of truth. Truth is simply that which is. Reality is that which you have come to understand it. It is your idea of the truth. Reality consists of things, all separate. Truth consists of only one cosmic energy. Truth consists of oneness, Reality consists of manyness. Reality is a crowd. Truth is integration. Before we enter into the sutras, this has to become the foundation, that knowledge is a curse. Jai Krishnamurti has said, to negate is silence. To negate what? To negate knowledge, to negate mind. To negate this constant occupation inside you, to create an unoccupied space. When you are unoccupied, you are in tune with the whole. When you are occupied, you have fallen out of tune. Hence, whenever it happens that you can attain a moment of silence, there is immense joy. In that moment, life has significance. In that moment, life has a grandeur beyond words. In that moment, life is a dance. In that moment, if even death comes, it will be a dance and a celebration. Because that moment knows nothing but joy. That moment is joyous. It is blissful. Knowledge has to be negated. But not because I am saying, or because Jai Krishnamurti says so, or because Gautam Buddha has said. If you negate because I am saying, then you will negate your knowledge, and whatsoever I am saying will become your knowledge in its place. You will substitute it. The negation has not to come from the mind. Otherwise, the mind is very tricky. Then whatsoever I say becomes your knowledge, you start clinging with it. You throw your old idols and you replace them with new ones. But it is the same game, played with new words, new ideas, new thoughts. Then how to negate knowledge? Not by another knowledge. Just seeing into the fact that knowledge creates distance. Just seeing into this fact intensely, totally, is enough. Not that you have to replace by something else. That intensity is fire. That intensity will reduce your knowledge to ashes. That intensity is enough. That intensity is what is known as insight. Insight will burn your knowledge, and it will not be replaced by another knowledge. Then there is emptiness, sunyata. Then there is nothingness. Because then there is no content. There is undisturbed, undistorted truth. You have to see what I am saying. You are not to learn what I am saying. Here, sitting with me every day, listening to me, don't start collecting knowledge. Here, listening to me, don't start holding. Listening to me should be an experiment in insight. You should listen with intensity, with totality, with as much awareness as it is possible for you. In that very awareness, you will see a point And that very seeing is transformation. Not that you have to do something else afterwards. The seeing itself brings the mutation. If some effort is needed, that simply shows you missed. If you come tomorrow and ask me, I have understood that knowledge is the curse, that knowledge creates distance, now how to drop it? Then you missed. If the how arises, then you missed. The how cannot arise, because the how is asking for more knowledge. The how is asking for methods, techniques, what should be done. And insight is enough. It need not be helped by any efforts. Its fire is more than enough to burn all knowledge that you carry within you. Just see the point. Listening to me, go with me. Listening to me, hold my hand and move in the spaces that I am trying you to move in. And see what I am saying. Don't argue. Don't say yes, don't say no. Don't agree, don't disagree. Just be with me in this moment. And suddenly the insight is there. If you are listening attentively, and by attention I don't mean concentration. By attention I simply mean you are listening with awareness, not with a dull mind. You are listening with intelligence, with aliveness. With openness. You are here now with me. That's what I mean by attention. You are nowhere else. You are not comparing in the mind what I am saying with your old thoughts. You are not comparing at all. You are not judging. What I am saying, you are not there judging inside within you whether it is right or not or how much is right. Just the other day, I was talking to a seeker. He has the quality of a seeker, but is burdened by knowledge. While I was talking to him, his eyes became full of tears. His heart was just going to open, and in that very moment the mind jumped in and destroyed the whole beauty of it. He was just moving towards the heart and opening. But immediately his mind came in. Those tears that were just on the verge to drop disappeared. His eyes became dry. What has happened? I said something with which he could not agree. He was agreeing with me up to a certain point. Then I said something which goes against his Jewish background, which goes against Kabbalah. And immediately, the whole energy changed. He said, everything is right, whatsoever you are saying is right. But this one thing, that God has no purpose. That existence exists purposelessly. This I cannot agree, because Kabbalah says just the opposite. That life has purpose. That God is purposive. That He is leading us towards a certain destiny. That there is a destination. He may not have even looked at it this way. That he missed in that moment, because comparison came in. What Kabbalah has to do with me? When you are with me, put away all your knowledge of Kabbalah, of Yoga, of Tantra, of this and that. When you are with me, be with me. If you are totally with me, and I am not saying that you are agreeing with me, remember, I am not saying that you are agreeing with me. There is no question of agreement or disagreement. When you see a rose flower, do you agree with it or disagree with it? When you see the sunrise, do you agree or do you disagree? When you see the moon in the night, you simply see it. Either you see it or you don't see it, but there is no question of agreement or disagreement. That way, be with me. That is the way of being with a master. Just be with me. I'm not trying to convince you about anything. I'm not trying to convert you to some theory, philosophy, dogma, to some church. No. I'm simply sharing what has happened to me. And in that very sharing, if you participate, it can happen to you too. It is infectious. Insight transforms. When I am saying knowledge is a curse, you can agree, disagree, missed. You just listen it. Just you sit into it. You go into the whole process of knowledge. You see how knowledge creates distance. How knowledge becomes a barrier. How knowledge stands in between. How knowledge goes on increasing and the distance goes on increasing. How innocence is lost through knowledge. How wonder is destroyed, crippled, murdered through knowledge. How life becomes a dull and boring affair through knowledge. Mystery is lost. And with the mystery, God is lost. Mystery disappears because you start having the idea that you know. When you know, how there can be mystery? Mystery is possible only when you don't know. And remember, man has not known a thing. All that we have gathered is just rubbish. The ultimate remains beyond grasp. What we have gathered are only facts. Truth remains untouched by our efforts. And that is the experience not only of Buddha, Krishna, Krishnamurti and Raman. That is the experience even of Edison, Newton, Albert Einstein. That is the experience of poets, painters, dancers. All the great intelligences of the world, they may be mystics, they may be poets, they may be scientists, are in absolutely agreement about one thing, that the more we know, the more we understand that life is an absolute mystery. Our knowledge does not destroy its mystery. It is only stupid people who think that because they know a little bit, now there is no more mystery in life. It is only the mediocre mind that becomes too much attached to knowledge. The intelligent mind remains above knowledge. He uses it, certainly uses it. It is useful, it is utilitarian, but knows perfectly well that all that is true is hidden. Remains hidden. We can go on knowing and knowing, but God remains unexhausted. Listen with insight, attention, totality. And in that very vision, you will see something, and that seeing changes you. You don't ask for the how. That is the meaning when Krishnamurti says to negate is silence. Insight negates. And when something is negated and nothing is posited instead, something has been destroyed and nothing has been put, replaced in its place, there is silence. Because there is a space. There is silence because the old has been thrown and new has not been brought in. That silence, Buddha calls sunyata. That silence is emptiness, nothingness. And only that nothingness can operate in the world of truth. Thought cannot operate there. Thought works only in the world of things, because thought is also a thing. Subtle, but it is also material. That's why thought can be regarded. That's why thought can be relayed, conveyed. I can throw a thought at you. You can hold it. You can have it. It can be taken and given. It is transferable because it is a thing. It is a material phenomenon. Emptiness cannot be given. Emptiness cannot be thrown at you. You can participate in it. You can move into it. But nobody can give it to you. It is non-transferable. And only emptiness operates in the world of truth. Truth is known only when mind is not. To know truth, mind has to cease. It has to go out of functioning. It has to be quiet, still, unmoving. Thought cannot operate into truth, but truth can operate through thoughts. You cannot attain to truth by thinking, but when you have attained it, you can use thinking in its service. That's what I am doing. That's what Buddha has done. That's what all the masters have done. What I am saying is a thought. But behind this thought is emptiness. That emptiness has not been produced by thought. That emptiness is beyond thought. Thought cannot touch it. Thought cannot even look at it. Have you observed one phenomenon that you cannot think about emptiness? You cannot make emptiness a thought. You cannot think about it. It is unthinkable. If you can think about it, it will not be emptiness at all. Thought has to go for emptiness to come. They never meet. Once emptiness has come, it can use all kinds of devices to express itself. insight is a state of no thought. Whenever you see something, you always see when there is no thought. Here also, listening to me, being with me, sometimes you see, but those moments are gaps, intervals. One thought has gone, another has not come, and there is a gap, and in that gap something strikes. Something starts vibrating. It is like somebody playing on a drum. The drum is empty inside. That's why it can be played upon. That emptiness vibrates. That beautiful sound that comes out is produced out of emptiness. When you are without a thought, then something is possible, immediately possible. Then you can see what I am saying. Then it will not be just a word heard. Then it will become an intuition, an insight, a vision. You have looked into it. You have shared it with me. Insight is a state of non-thinking, no thought. It is a gap, an interval in the process of thought. And in that gap is the glimpse, the truth. The English word empty comes from a root which means at leisure, unoccupied. That's a beautiful word. If you go to the root is very pregnant. It means at leisure, unoccupied. Whenever you are unoccupied, at leisure, you are empty. And remember, the proverb that says that the empty mind is the devil's workshop is just nonsense. Just the opposite is the truth. The occupied mind is the devil's workshop. The empty mind is God's workshop, not devil's. But you have to understand what I mean by empty. At leisure, relaxed, non-tense, not moving, not desiring, not going anywhere. Just being here, utterly here. An empty mind is a pure presence. And all is possible in that pure presence, because the whole existence comes out of that pure presence. These trees grow out of that pure presence. These stars are born out of this pure presence. We are here. All the Buddhas have come out of this pure presence. In that pure presence, you are in God, you are God. Occupied, you fall. Occupied, you have to be expelled from the Garden of Eden. Unoccupied, you are back in the garden. Unoccupied, you are back at home. When the mind is not occupied by reality, by things, by thoughts, then there is that which is. And that which is the truth. Only in emptiness there is a meeting, merging. Only in emptiness you open to truth and truth enters in you. Only in emptiness you become pregnant with truth. These are the three states of the mind. First, content and consciousness. You always have contents in the mind, a thought moving, a desire arising, anger, greed, ambition. You always have some content in the mind. The mind is never unoccupied. The traffic goes on, day in, day out. While awake it is there, while asleep it is there. While awake you call it thinking, while asleep you call it dreaming. It is the same process. Dreaming is a little more primitive, that's all. Because it thinks in pictures. It does not use concepts, it uses pictures. It is more primitive, like small children, they think in pictures. So in small children's books you have to make big pictures, colorful. Because they think through pictures. Through pictures they will learn words. By and by those pictures become smaller and smaller, and then they disappear. The primitive man also thinks in pictures. The ancient most languages are pictorial languages. Chinese is a pictorial language. It has no alphabet. It is the ancient most language. In the night, you again become primitive. You forget your sophistication of the day. And you start thinking in pictures. But it is the same. And the psychoanalyst's insight is valuable, that he looks into your dreams, because then there is more truth, because you are more primitive. You are not trying to deceive anybody. You are more authentic. In the day, you have a personality around you, which hides you. Layers upon layers of personality. It is very difficult to find out the true man. You will have to dig deep, and it hurts. And the man will resist. But in the night, just as you put your clothes away, you put your personalities too away. They are not needed, because you will not be communicating with anybody. You will be alone in your bed. And you will not be in the world. You will be absolutely in your private realm. There is no need to hide and no need to pretend. That's why the psychoanalyst tries to go into your dreams, because they so much more clearly who you are. But it is the same game, played in different languages, but the game is not different. This is the ordinary state of the mind, mind and content, consciousness plus content. The second state of the mind is consciousness without content. That's what meditation is. You are fully alert, and there is a gap, an interval. No thought is encountered. There is no thought before you. You are not asleep, you are awake, but there is no thought. This is meditation. First state called mind, second state called meditation, and then there is a third state. When the content has disappeared, the object has disappeared, the subject cannot remain for long, because they exist together. They produced each other. When the subject is alone, it can only hang around a little while more, just out of the momentum of the past. Without the content, the consciousness cannot be there long. It will not be needed. Because a consciousness is always a consciousness about something. When you say conscious, it can be asked about what? You say, I am conscious of. That object is needed, is a must for the subject to exist. Once the object has disappeared, soon the subject will also disappear. First goes the contents, then disappears consciousness. Then the third stage called samadhi. No content, no consciousness. But remember, this no content, no consciousness is not a state of unconsciousness. It is a state of super consciousness, of transcendental consciousness. Consciousness now is only conscious about itself. Consciousness has turned upon itself. The circle is complete. You have come home. This is the third state, samadhi. And this third state is what Buddha means by sunyata. First drop the content, you become half empty. Then drop consciousness, you become fully empty. And this full emptiness is the most beautiful that can happen. The greatest benediction. In this nothingness, in this emptiness, in this selflessness, in this sunyata, there is complete security and stability. You will be surprised to know about this. Complete security and stability when you are not. All fears disappear. Because what is the basic fear? The basic fear is the fear of death. All other fears are just reflections of the basic fear. All other fears can be reduced to one fear, the fear of death. The fear that one day I may have to disappear. That one day I may have to die. I am. And the day is coming when I will not be. That frightens. That is the fear. To avoid that fear, we start moving in such a way so that we can live as long as possible. And we try to secure our lives. We start compromising. We start becoming more and more secure, safe, because of the fear. We become paralyzed. Because the more secure you are, the more safe you are, the less alive you will be. Life exists in challenges. Life exists in crisis. Life needs insecurity. It grows in the soil of insecurity. Whenever you are insecure, you will find yourself more alive, more alert. That's why rich people become dull. A kind of stupidity and a kind of stupor surrounds them. They are so secure. There is no challenge. They are so secure, they need not be intelligent. They are so secure for what? They need intelligence. Intelligence is needed when there is challenge. Intelligence is provoked by a challenge. So because of the fear of death, we strive for security, for bank balance, for insurance, for marriage, for a settled life, for a home. We become part of a country. We join a political party. We join a a religious church. We become Hindus, Christians, Mohammedans. These are all ways to find security. These are all ways to find some place to belong to, a country, a church. Because of this fear, politicians and priests go on exploiting you. If you are not in any fear, no politician, no priest can exploit you. It is only out of fear he can exploit. Because he can provide, at least he can promise that this will make you secure. This will be your security, I can guarantee. The goods may never be delivered, that's another thing. But the promise. And the promise keeps people exploited, oppressed. The promise keeps people in bondage. Once you have known this inner emptiness, then there is no fear. Because death has already happened. In that emptiness it has happened. In that emptiness you have disappeared. How you can be afraid anymore? About what? About whom? And who can be afraid? In this emptiness, all fears disappear because death has already happened. Now there is no more any death possible. You feel a kind of deathlessness, timelessness. Eternity has arrived. Now you don't look for security, there is no need. This is the state of a sannyasin. This is the state where a man need not be a part of a country, need not be a part of a church, or stupid things like that. It is only when you have become nothing that you can be yourself. It looks paradoxical. And you need not compromise. Because it is out of fear and greed one compromises. And you can live in rebellion. Because there is nothing to lose. You can become a rebellion. There is nothing to fear. Nobody can kill you. You have done already yourself that thing. Nobody can take anything away from you. You have dropped all that can be taken away from you. Now you are in nothingness. You are in nothingness. Hence the paradoxical phenomenon that in this nothingness arises a great security, a great safety, a stability. Because there is no more death possible. And with death disappears time. With death disappear all the problems that are created by death and by time. In the wake of all these disappearances, what is left is a pure sky. This pure sky is samadhi, nirvana. Buddha is talking about it. These sutras have been addressed to one of Buddha's greatest disciples, Sariputra. Why to Sariputra? The first day I told you there are seven planes, seven rungs of the ladder. The seventh is the transcendental. Zen, Tantra, Tao, The sixth is the spiritual transcendental yoga. Up to the sixth, method remains important. How remains important? Up to the sixth, discipline remains important. Ritual remains important. Techniques remain important. Only when you reach to the seventh, you see that nothing is needed to be. Sariputra is addressed in these sutras because Sariputra was at the sixth center, the sixth rung. He was one of the greatest disciples of Buddha. Buddha had 80 great disciples. Sariputra is one of the chief amongst those 80. He was the most knowledgeable man around Buddha. He was the greatest scholar and the pandit around Buddha. When he had come to Buddha, he himself had 5,000 disciples. When he had come to Buddha for the first time, he had come to argue, debate and defeat Buddha. He had come with his 5,000 disciples to impress. And when he stood before Buddha, Buddha laughed. And Buddha said to him, Sariputra, you know much, but you do not know at all. I can see you have accumulated great knowledge, but you are empty. You have come to discuss and debate and to defeat me. But if you really want to discuss with me, you will have to wait at least 1 year. Sariputta said, 1 year? For what? Buddha said, you will have to remain silent for 1 year. That will be the price to be paid. If you can remain silent for 1 year, then you can discuss with me. Because what I am going to talk to you will come out of silence. You need a little experience of it. And I see, Sariputra, you have not even tasted a single moment of silence. You are so full of knowledge. Your head is heavy. I feel compassion for you, Sariputra. You have been carrying such a load for many lives. You are not a Brahmin only in this life, Sariputra. You have been a Brahmin for many lives. And for many lives you have carried the Vedas and the scriptures. It has been your style for many lives. But I see a possibility. You are knowledgeable, but yet the promise is there. You are knowledgeable, but your knowledge has not completely blocked your being. There are few windows still left. I would like for 1 year to clean those windows, and then there is a possibility of our meeting and talking and being. You be here for 1 year. This was strange. Sariputra has been traveling all over the country, defeating people. That was one of the things in India. Knowledgeable people used to travel all over the country and defeat. Great debates and discussions. Marathon debates. And that was thought to be one of the greatest thing to do. If somebody has become victorious all over the country and he has defeated all the scholars, that was a great ego satisfaction. That man was thought to be bigger than kings, emperors. That man was thought to be bigger than the rich people. Sariputra was traveling, and naturally you cannot declare yourself the victorious one if you have not defeated Buddha. So he had come for that. He said, okay, if I have to wait for 1 year, I will wait. And 1 year he was sitting there in silence with Buddha. In 1 year the silence settled in him. And after 1 year Buddha asked him, now you can discuss and defeat me, Sariputra. I will be immensely happy to be defeated by you. And he laughed and touched his feet and said, initiate me. This 1 year silence, listening to you, there have been few moments when the insight has happened to me, although I had come as an antagonist. But I thought, while I am here sitting for 1 year, why not listen to this man, what he is saying? So out of curiosity, I started listening. But sometimes those moments came and you penetrated me. And you touched my heart. And you played on my inner organ. And I have heard the music. You have defeated me without defeating me. Sariputra became Buddha's disciple, and his 5,000 disciples also became Buddha's disciples. Sariputra was one of the very well-known scholars of those days. These sutras are addressed to Sariputra. Here, O Sariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Here, O Sariputra, what does Buddha mean by here? He means his space. He says, from the vision of my world, from the transcendental standpoint, the space where I exist and the eternity where I exist, here, O Sariputra, form is emptiness and the very emptiness is form. This is one of the most important assertions. The whole Buddhist approach depends on this. That the manifest is the unmanifest. That the form is nothing but the form of emptiness itself. And the emptiness is also nothing but the form, the possibility of the form. The statement is illogical and obviously appears nonsense. How can form be emptiness? They are opposites. How can emptiness be form? They are polarities. One thing has to be understood before we can enter into the sutra rightly. Buddha is not logical, Buddha is dialectical. There are two approaches towards reality. One is logical. Of that approach, Aristotle is the father in the West. It simply moves in a line, clear-cut line. It never allows the opposite. The opposite has to be discarded. This approach says A is A and never not A. A cannot be not A. This is the formulation of Aristotelian logic. And it looks perfectly right, because we have all been brought up with that logic in the schools, colleges, universities. The world is dominated by Aristotle. A is A and never not A. The second approach towards reality is dialectical. In the West, that approach is associated with the name of Heraclitus, Hegel. The dialectical process says, life moves through polarities, through opposites, just as a river flows through two banks which oppose each other. But those opposing banks keep the river flowing between them. This is more existential. Electricity has two poles, positive and negative. If Aristotle's logic is of existence, then electricity is very, very illogical. Then God himself is illogical, because he produces new life out of the meeting of a man and a woman, which are opposites, yin and yang, male and female. If God has been brought up by Aristotle in an Aristotelian logic, in the linear logic, then homosexuality would have been the norm and heterosexuality would have been perversion. Then man will love man and woman will love woman. Then opposites cannot meet. But God is dialectical. Everywhere opposites are meeting. In you, birth and death are meeting. Everywhere opposites are meeting, day and night, summer and winter. The thorn and the flower, they are meeting. They are on the same branch. They come out of the same source. Men and women, youth and old age, beauty and ugliness, body and soul, the world and God, all are opposites. This is a symphony of the opposites. Opposites are not only meeting but creating great symphony. Only opposites can create symphony. Otherwise, life will be a monotony, not a symphony. Life will be a boredom. If there was only one note continuously being repeated, it is bound to create boredom. There are opposite notes. Thesis meeting with the antithesis, creating a synthesis, and in its own turn, synthesis again becomes a thesis, creates an antithesis, and a higher synthesis evolves. That's how life moves. This Buddha's approach is dialectical, and it is more existential, more true, more valid. A man loves a woman loves a man, then something else has to be understood too. Now, biologists say, and psychologists agree, that man is not only man, he is woman too. And woman is not simply woman, she is man too. So when a man and a woman meet, there are not two persons meeting, but four persons meeting. The man is meeting with the woman, but the man has a hidden woman in himself. So has the woman a hidden man in herself. They are also meeting. The meeting is on double planes. It is more intricate, more complex, more intertwined. A man is man and woman both. Why? Because he comes out of both. Something has been contributed to you by your father, and something has been contributed to you by your mother. whosoever you are. A man flows into your blood and a woman too. You have to be both, because you are the meeting of the polar opposites. You are a synthesis. It is impossible to deny one and just be the other. That's what has been done. Aristotle has been followed literally in every way, and that has created much problems for man. And such problems which seem to be insoluble if Aristotle has to be followed. Man has been taught to be just man. Never saw any feminine trait in you. Never saw any softness of the heart. Never saw any receptivity. Always be aggressive. Never cry, never weep, man has been taught, because tears are feminine. Women have been taught never to be in any way like the male. Never show aggression, never show expression. Always remain passive, receptive. This is against reality. And this has crippled both. In a better world, with better understanding, a man will be both, a woman will be both. Because sometimes a man needs to be a woman. There are moments when he needs to be soft, tender moments, love moments. And there are moments when a woman needs to be expressive and aggressive, in anger, in defense, in rebellion. If woman is simply passive, then she will turn into a slave automatically. A passive woman is bound to become a slave. That's what happened down the ages. And an aggressive man, emphatically aggressive and never tender, is bound to create wars, neurosis in the world, violence. Man has been fighting, continuously fighting. It seems that man exists on the earth just to fight. In 3,000 years, there have been 5,000 wars. The war continues somewhere or other. The earth is never whole and healthy without war. Never a moment without war. Either it is in Korea, or it is in Vietnam, or it is in Israel, or India, Pakistan, or in Bangladesh. Somewhere the massacre has to continue. Man has to kill. To remain man, he has to kill. 75% of energy is put into war efforts, in creating more bombs, hydrogen bombs, neutron bombs, and so on and so forth. It seems that man's whole purpose here on earth is war. The war heroes are respected the most. The war politicians become the great names in the history. Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, these names are going to remain. Why? Because they fought great wars. They destroyed. Whether in aggression or in defense, that is not much the point. But these were the warmongers. And nobody ever knows who was aggressive. Whether Germany was aggressive or not. It all depends who writes the history. Whosoever wins will write the history. And he will prove the other was the aggressive. The history would have been totally different if Adolf Hitler was victorious. Yes, Nuremberg trial would have been there. But Americans and English and French generals would have been there, and the politicians. And the history would have been written by Germans. Naturally, they would have a different vision. Nobody knows what is true. One thing is certain, that man puts his whole energy into war effort. The reason is that man has been taught to be just man. His woman has been denied. So no man is whole. And so is the case with woman. No woman is whole. She has been denied her man part. See, when she was a small child, she cannot fight with boys. She cannot climb on the trees. She has to play with dolls. She has to play home. This is a very, very distorted vision. Man is both, so woman is, and both are needed to create a real harmonious human being. The existence is dialectical. And opposites are not only opposites, they are complementaries too. Buddha says, "Hear, O Sariputra, in my world, Sariputra, in my space, in my time, Sariputra, at the seventh rung of the ladder, in that this state of no mind, in this state of samadhi, in this state of nirvana, enlightenment, form is emptiness, man is woman, and woman is man. And life is death, and death is life. Opposites are not opposites, Sariputra. They are interpenetrating each other. They exist through each other." To show this basic insight, Buddha says, form is formlessness, and formlessness is form. The unmanifest becomes manifest, and the manifest again becomes unmanifest. They are not different, Sariputra. They are one. The duality is only apparent. Deep down, it is all one. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. The whole life and the whole existence consists of polar opposites. But only on the surface they are different. These opposites are like my two hands. I can oppose them with each other. I can even manage a kind of conflict, fight between them. But my left hand and my right hand are both my hands. Within me they are one. Exactly that is the case. Why Buddha is saying this thing to Sariputra? Because if you understand this, your worries will disappear. Then there is no worry. Life is death. Death is life. To be is a way towards not to be. And not to be is a way towards to be. It is the same game. Then there is no fear. Then there is no problem. With this insight, a great acceptance arises. Hear, O Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete. Buddha says all dharmas are full of emptiness, that nothingness exists at everything's core, that nothingness exists in a tree, that nothingness exists in a rock, that nothingness exists in a star. Now scientists will agree. They say when a star collapses, it becomes a black hole. Nothingness. But that nothingness is not just nothingness. It is immensely powerful. It is very full, overflowing. The concept, the hypothesis of a dark hole, of a black hole, is of immense value to understand Buddha. A star exists for millions and trillions of years. But one day, it has to die. Everything that is born has to die. Man exists for 70 years. Then what happens? Exhausted, tired, he disappears. He falls back into the original unity. So it is going to happen to everything, sooner or later. The Himalayas will disappear one day. So this earth will disappear one day. So this sun will disappear one day. But when a great star disappears, where it will disappear? It collapses within itself. It is such a big mass. It collapses. Just as a man walking, an old man, falls on the street and collapses. If you leave the man there, sooner or later, his body will disappear, disintegrate into the mud, into the earth. If you leave it there for many years, then bones will also disappear into dust. The man was there one day walking, living, loving, fighting. And now all has disappeared into a black hole. So it happens with a star. When a star collapses into itself, it becomes a black hole. Why it is called a black hole? Because now there is no mass. There is only pure emptiness. What Buddha calls sunyata. And the sunyata, the pure emptiness, is so powerful that if you come under the impact of it, near it, in its vicinity, you will be pulled into the emptiness, and you will also collapse and disappear. For space travel, this is going to be a future problem, because many stars are there which have become black holes, and you cannot see it because it is nothing. It is just absence. You cannot see it, and you can come across it. If a spaceship comes near it, under its gravitation, it will be simply pulled in. Then there is no way to get out of it. It is impossible to find a way to get out of it. The pull is going to be so big, it will be simply pulled in, and it will disappear and collapse. And you will never hear about the spaceship, where it went, what happened to it, what happened to the space travelers. This black hole is very, very alike with Buddha's concept of emptiness. All forms collapse and disappear into blackness. And then again, when they have rested for a long time, they bubble up. Again a star is born. This goes on. Life and death, life and death, this goes on. This is the way the existence moves. First, it becomes manifested, then becomes tired, goes into unmanifestation, then again revives its energy through rest, relaxation, again becomes manifest. The whole day you work, you become tired. In the night, you disappear in your sleep in a black hole. You put your lights off. You slip under your blanket, you close your eyes, then within moments consciousness is gone. You have collapsed within words. There are moments when even dreams are no more there, then sleep is the deepest. In that deep sleep you are in a black hole. You are dead. For a time being you are in death, resting in death, and then in the morning you are again back, full of juice and gesto and life, again rejuvenated. If you had a really good deep sleep without dreams, the morning is so fresh, so vital, so radiant, you are again young. If you know how to sleep deeply, you know how to revive yourself again and again. By the evening, again you are collapsing, tired, exhausted of the day's activities. The same happens to everything. Man is a miniature of the whole existence. What happens to man happens to whole existence on a bigger scale, that's all. Every night you disappear into nothingness. Every morning you come into form. Form, no form, form, no form. This is how life moves. These are the two steps. Here, O Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped. And Buddha is saying, nothing has to be done, only understanding. This is a radical statement. It can transform your whole life if you can see it as an insight. They are not produced or stopped. Nobody is producing these forms. And nobody is stopping these forms. Buddha does not believe in a God as manipulator, as a controller, as a creator. No. That will be a duality, an unnecessary hypothesis. Buddha says it is happening on its own. It is natural. Nobody is doing it. It is not that first God thinks, let there be light, as it says in the Bible. So there is light. And then one day he says, no, let there be no light. So the light disappears. Why bring this God and why give him such ugly work, and he will have to do it forever and hour. Let there be light and let there be no light. Let there be light. Now let this man be there and now let him die. Just think of him and his boredom. Buddha relieves him. He says it is unnecessary. It is just natural. Trees bring seeds. Then seeds bring trees. And trees again bring seeds. What is a seed? The disappearance of the tree. The tree has moved into no form. You can carry a seed in your pocket. 1,000 seeds you can carry in your pocket, but you cannot carry 1,000 trees in your pocket. The trees have form, bulk, mass. The seed has nothing. And if you look into the seed, you will find nothing. If you had not seen, not known that a seed becomes a tree, and somebody gives you a seed and says that, look, this seed is very, very magical. It can become a big tree, and there will be many fruits for many years, and great foliage, and flowers, and greenery, and birds will come and make nests there. And you will say, what are you talking about? Out of this is small people? Do you think I am stupid or something? How it can happen? It can't happen. But you know it happens, that's why you don't take any note of it. A miracle is happening. The small seed is carrying the whole blueprint. of the tree, of the leaves, the shape and the size and the number, and the branches, and the form of the branches, and the length, and the height of the tree, and the life, and how many fruits, and how many flowers will come out of it, and how many seeds. Finally, this one seed is going to produce. Scientists say that even a single seed is enough to make the whole earth green. It has immense potentiality. Not only the whole earth, one single seed can fill all the planets with greenery. Because one seed produces millions of seeds, then each seed will produce millions, and so on and so forth. The whole existence can become green out of a single seed. That nothingness is very potential, very powerful, immense, enormous, vast. Buddha says nobody is producing it and nobody is stopping it. Buddha says there is no need to go to a temple and to pray and tell to God, do this, don't do that. There is nobody. Then what is his message? He says, accept it. It is so. It is in the nature of things. It is just natural. Things come and go. In this acceptance, in this tathata, in this suchness, all worries disappear. You are freed from worries. Then there is no problem. And nothing can be stopped, and nothing can be changed, and nothing can be produced. Things are as they are, and things will be as they will be. So there is nothing for you to do. You can just watch these things happening. You can participate in these things. Be. In that being there is silence. In that being there is joy. That being is freedom. These are not defiled or immaculate. This existence is neither impure nor pure. There is nobody who is a sinner and nobody who is a saint. Buddha's insight is utterly revolutionary. He says nothing can be impure and nothing can be pure. Things are just as they are. It is all mind games that we play around, and we create the idea of purity, and then comes impurity. We create the idea of the saint and comes in the sinner. You want sinners to disappear? They can disappear only when your sins have disappeared, not before that. They exist together. You want immorality to disappear? Then morality has to go. It is morality that creates immorality. It is the moral ideals that create condemnation for few people who cannot follow them, who cannot go with them. And you can make anything immoral. Just create an idea that this is moral. Anything you can make out of it, a holy cow, and then it becomes a problem. Buddha says nothing is ever defiled and nothing is ever immaculate. Purity, impurity are mind attitudes. Can you tell about a tree whether it is moral or immoral? Can you tell about an animal whether he is a sinner or a saint? Try to see this ultimate vision. There is no sinner, no saint, nothing moral, nothing immoral. In this acceptance, where is the possibility of worrying? There is nothing to improve either. And there is no goal, because there is no value. This journey is a journey without any goal. It is a pure journey. It is a play, a leela. And there is nobody behind it, doing it. All is happening and there is nobody doing it. If the doer is there, then problem arises. Then pray to the doer. Then persuade the doer. Then become friends with the doer. Then you will be benefited, and those who are not friends with the doer will be deprived. They will suffer in hell. That's what Christians, Hindus, Mohammedans think. Mohammedans think those who are Mohammedans are going to heaven. And those who are not, poor fellows, they are going to hell. And the same is the case with Christians and the Hindus. The Hindus think those who are not Hindus, they have no chance. The Christians think those who don't come through the church, those who don't pass through the church, are going to suffer eternal hell. Not limited, unlimitedly, forever. Buddha says there is no sinner, no saint. Nothing is pure, nothing is impure. Things are as they are. Just persuade a tree and ask the tree that why you are green, why you are not red. And if the tree listens to you, she will go neurotic. Why? I am not red. Why? Really, the question is relevant. Why I am green? Condemn the green and praise the red. And sooner or later you will find the tree on some psychiatrist's couch. Being analyzed, helped. First you create the problem and then comes the savior. It is a beautiful business. Buddha cuts the very roots. He says, you are the way you are. There is nothing to improve, nowhere to go. And this is my whole approach too. You are as perfect as you can be. More is not possible. The more will only create trouble for you. The idea for the more will drive you mad. Accept nature. Live naturally. Simple. Spontaneous. Moment to moment. And there is holiness. Because you are whole, not because you have become a saint. Not defiled or immaculate, nor deficient or complete. Nothing is complete and nothing is incomplete. These values are meaningless. Says Buddha, here, O Sariputra, where I exist, nothing is good, nothing is bad. Here where I exist, sansara and nirvana are the same. There is no distinction between this world and that world. There is no distinction between the profane and the sacred. Here where I exist, all distinctions have disappeared because distinctions are made by thought. When thought disappears, distinctions disappear. Sinners are created by thought and saints are created by thought. Good and bad are created by thought. It is all thought that makes distinctions. Buddha says when knowledge disappears, thought disappears, there is no duality. It is all oneness. There is a famous saying of Sozan, in the higher realms of true suchness, there is neither self nor other. When direct identification is sought, we can only say not two. One in all, all in one. If this is realized, no more worry about your not being perfect. One in all in one, if this is realized, no more worry about your not being perfect. There is no perfection, no imperfection. See it and see it right now. Don't come later on and ask me how to do it. There is no how either. How brings knowledge, and knowledge is the curse. Without the distorting media of thought, you fall into unity with the whole. Without thought functioning between you and the real, all distances disappear. You are bridged. And that's what man is hankering constantly. You are feeling uprooted. Uprooted from the whole. That's your misery. And you are uprooted because of this distorting media of the thought. Drop this distorting media of thought. Drop these mediums. Look into reality as it is, with no idea in your mind, with no idea how it should be. Look with innocence. Look with not knowing, and all worries disappear. In that disappearing of the worries, you become a Buddha. You are a Buddha, but you are missing because you are carrying distorting mediums around you. You have perfect eyes and you are wearing glasses. Those glasses are distorting. They are coloring. They are making things as they are not. Throw the glasses. That's what is the meaning when we say throw the mind. Negate the mind, and there is silence. And in that silence, you are divine. You have never been anything else. You have been always that. But the recognition comes back. The realization comes back. You suddenly see the point that you were trying to put legs on a snake. There was no need in the first place. The snake is perfectly perfect. Without legs, he moves perfectly. Just out of compassion, you were trying to put legs. If you succeed, you will kill the snake. It is fortunate that you never can succeed. You are trying to become knowledgeable, and that's why you are losing your perception, your knowing, your capacity to see. That's what I mean by putting legs on a snake. Knowing is your nature. There is no need to have knowledge to know. In fact, knowledge is the hindrance. Knowledge is the curse. Negate knowledge and be. And you are a Buddha. And you have always been a Buddha. enough for today.